You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, community supported, solar powered.
Yes.
Radio broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield. And if you're listening to this on Friday, July 26th, you may be having trouble getting around the Cultural District.
Yes.
With our 25,000 RAGBRAI writers and assorted crew members.
25,000.
Yeah, I think it's 25,000 total, including the writers and,
right,
the crew.
And their supports. Okay. Yeah.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, whom I haven't seen for a few weeks,
yeah.
Caroline Kilborn.
Yeah, because we just haven't connected. And this it's a beautiful, beautiful weather. This is perfect Iowa. Perfect Iowa weather.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
Low humidity, just great.
Not too hot.
Not too
good,
hot.
It's a good day to be riding your bike.
Yes, I'm sure they're very pleased with this weather.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Our guests may not know about RAGBRAI. It's a tradition of, I don't know how many years, ride across Iowa.
Yeah, Register's annual great bike ride across Iowa.
And they go from Council Bluffs or somewhere.
From the Missouri River to the Mississippi River.
Mississippi, and dip their back wheel in one and their front wheel in the other.
And this is our first day back in the studio. I was traveling back in town, and we have a guest with a really interesting and very topical,
oh my,
and timely,
yes,
book.
Yes, indeed.
Do you want to introduce?
Yes, our guest today is Suzanne Young, who currently lives in Tempe, Arizona, where she teaches high school English. Imagine that. That's what I used to teach. When not writing obsessively, Suzanne can be found searching for her own tragic memories for inspiration. She is the author of several books for teens, including The Program, and that's the one we're going to talk about today. The
right.
Program, A Need So Beautiful and a Want So Wicked. And it is a interesting, interesting book.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Suzanne.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, tell us a little bit. You've been writing for all your life, or is it a fairly, obviously not too recent occupation, because you already have a number of books published. How did you get started?
Well, I'd always been writing back in middle school was kind of when I started, and I went to college for writing. But then I became a teacher, and I was focused on teaching. And then when I moved to Oregon about 7 years ago is when I wrote my first full-length novel. That one didn't sell, but five books later, my first book sold back in 2008, and I've been writing ever since.
Now, that's interesting. That so it took, you had five practice books?
I did. it was just a matter of, I wasn't sure what kind of genre I wanted to write, so I tried a bunch of different ones, and I found that the teen voice was the one that I was able to connect with.
And where are those five practice ones now? Are they in a drawer somewhere?
On my computer in what I call the novel graveyard, and so I will occasionally go back and look at them, and maybe there's a little idea that I use then for another book.
Okay, so it's not wasted by any means.
No, I think writing is never a waste. I think there's always something, whether it takes me down a different path and gives me another fresh idea, or sometimes it's a character that just wasn't in the right book, and then I'll take that character and kind of give them a new situation to be in, and that works.
Yeah, good. Well, being a teacher, you have a lot of possibilities for ideas from
true,
your
I
students.
True, I get to see and hear all sorts of teenage drama.
I'll
in my books. It's funny because my students always say, like, oh, can you write me into a book? And I'm like, no, because your real life is kind of boring compared to fiction. Like, there has to be some kind of exaggeration in the fiction. So they like to think that they'll one day be inspiration, but if anything, maybe I take, like, a phrase or two that I hear to kind of help with keeping it current for teenagers.
That's good.
Now, Suzanne, we've talked to a lot of writers over the years, and quite a few don't get the first book they wrote published. But to write five before you're able to get published, what kept you going?
It's funny. My sister-in-law was I had always written short stories, and I started to write this book. And when it got to about 80 pages, I was like, "This is a really long short story." So my sister-in-law was reading along. I would send her pages. And she just loved it, and she wanted to know more, like, what happens next? And so that made me finish the book. And then I went online, because I didn't know how to publish a novel. I had never even thought about it, really. And I went online and met a lot of other writers who were just starting out, and we kind of just encouraged each other to keep going. And so there's a lot of rejection in writing. I don't think people realize how much rejection there is. And with each rejection letter, you know, we would kind of talk about it, and then I would just go and start writing the next book. And I think there, for me, there's something really addicting about writing. Like, I love getting lost in a book. I love telling a story. And so I always wrote because I wanted to tell a story. Even when I was feeling very down and thought I would never, ever sell a book, I just kept going because I really liked the feeling of it. And then I surrounded myself with people who encouraged me.
So you continued submitting during that whole time.
I did. I think I had gotten about 100 rejection letters over the course of those first few novels.
But I
kept going. And just because it's a rejection isn't necessarily a bad thing, because some of the rejections were, this book isn't quite right, but I love your style. Send me what else you have. And so my agent that I have now, my literary agent, was actually, he works with one of the agents who had rejected all of my manuscripts. And then I got to one that he really liked. And he said, I'm going to give you to this agent because I think you guys would be a great fit. And that was how it came about. So sometimes even these rejections will lead to an eventual contract.
So it can be a positive rejection.
It really can. You just have to learn from each rejection, and that's how I kind of learned what was expected and what would be a good hook to get an agent and eventually an editor.
So how did you, well, you said you kept sending and someone finally liked it, but did you do, like, did you go to conferences, or how did you actually learn what it would take to get their interest?
So I started just researching online and finding a group. It was Absolute Right. And I found this group, and you have a lot of aspiring authors, but you also have some that are already published. And we all kind of give each other advice. And then I went about it in kind of a weird way. So after all the rejections, I had gotten an agent, not the agent I have now, but an agent who was just starting out. And those books did not sell. Like, they didn't sell. And then she eventually dropped me, because that's how it sometimes happens. And so she dropped me, and I was feeling very despondent. And so I said, well, I'm just going to email an editor, one of the editors who rejected it. And that editor at Penguin actually ended up loving my first book and bought it before I got an agent. And then I got an agent to help negotiate the deal. So it was kind of a roundabout way. But after I sold that is when I started going to conferences. And that's how I learned about the business. Like, first I had to learn about writing and submitting, but there's a business. And that's something that you always will learn, and it's kind of something you just have to always be on the lookout for, because things change quite a bit. People move around to different houses, and so that's why conferences are great, because you get to know, like, the current situation in all of the publishers.
So there is a process in the publishing, and it's good to know how it works.
Exactly, yeah. I think you just need to kind of give yourself as much information as you can so that you can make the best decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Suzanne, do you like the business side of the business of being a writer?
I don't think I do. I try my best. I have, again, I've surrounded myself with really smart people who know the business really well. I think because I am one of those people that doesn't give up, that's what's gotten me to this point. You know, the thing is, even if you get a book published, there's nothing to say that it will be successful. And, you know, my first few books did get a lot of critical acclaim, but didn't get the same commercial success. I've been through 3 publishers. I was with Penguin and HarperCollins, and now I'm with Simon & Schuster, and I found kind of my fit there. Like, they're sort of just the perfect style for my books. And so that's just, it's a lot of trial and error, and the business part is kind of the tough part. Like, that's where you got to harden yourself.
Well, it's interesting because, just like you say, that a rejection is not necessarily a bad thing. Sometimes a sale is not necessarily the best thing either, because like, we had a guest on a few years ago whose first book sold to a major publisher for a really large advance, you know, fairly large for a first-time author, and then it did not sell. And because of that, he was unable to place another book for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Whereas if his first sale had been at a more moderate level with more moderate expectations, he could have built on that.
On that, yeah. Yeah.
So I actually see that quite a bit. I think we're starting to get out of that trend, but it was happening quite a bit a few years ago. And That's also, you know, for me, having to switch publishers, I mean, that's also part of it, too, because you have these certain expectations. But again, as the author, you only have so much that you can do to promote your books. You also, you don't want to, you should always be putting your time into writing another book instead of, you know, I don't want to spend all of my time promoting. I would rather spend time with my family and teach and write the next book. So there's always kind of a balancing act.
But speaking of promoting,
right, like not every sale is the right sale. So I think it's always important to just have the next book ready.
Do you have to go on tour to promote your books?
I did go on tour. I've never gone on a tour until the program, and it had gotten such an overwhelmingly positive response. And I got to go on a book tour, which was interesting because it was right at the end of school, so we had to kind of work it around my final exam schedule. But yeah, I got to. I went on a West Coast tour, and then in May they had me in New York City for BEA, which is a big conference they have out there, a Booksellers Expo. And I got to do a lot of promotion there, and that's really fun. That was a really, really great time. And then I do local book signings here, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the program came out April 30th, is that the correct date?
Yes.
And you've got another book coming out very soon, I see, on your webpage.
Yeah, next month I had co-authored a book with Kat Patrick, who's a friend of mine, and we started writing a book together, and we ended up selling it, and that is called Just Like Fate, and that comes out August 27th.
Wow, that's really exciting.
I'll say, wow.
Two books so close together.
I barely had time to catch up on what I missed over the summer, and now I have another book coming out. So that's it's a good problem to have, I guess.
Well, let's talk about the program. It's a very serious subject.
Very serious, yes.
Yeah. So why don't you give kind of the bird's eye view of what the program is about?
Yeah, absolutely. The program is a book about, it's set in kind of an alternate reality, a little bit in the future, where teen suicide has become an epidemic, and it's killing one in three teens. They don't quite know what the cause is, and the point of the book is not to figure out the cause. It's about the cure that the government has kind of come up with, and it is called the program. And if anyone is showing signs of depression, they then take them to a facility where they give them therapy and medication to slowly erase all of their triggering memories. And then they send the teens back, somewhat like Stepford children, at least that's the way they view it, where they are just perfectly balanced and they can't remember anything bad that ever happened to them. But along with that, you also have friends and boyfriends or girlfriends that would have been erased. And it becomes a question of who are we without our memories, but also there's hope at the end. Like, here is this epidemic. Here are these people that are suffering through depression and suicidal thoughts. But the book is about finding hope.
And what led you to write this?
I had actually started a couple different books before I came on this one. And I had my own struggles with depression when I was in high school. And I didn't have anyone to inspire hope. I just kind of I had to fight through it myself. And I started writing a book that was very similar to my own situation. And I found that because it was so close and because it was so realistic, when you see things like that, they don't necessarily translate well into fiction. And for me, I had to exaggerate the story to this epidemic status to be able to kind of, for people to see a reflection of real life in it. It's kind of interesting that way, that if you exaggerate it into this world, you're able to see the truth more clearly because it doesn't feel as, like, preachy or, you know, it doesn't feel like I'm trying to instill something. It's more of a story that they can look at from an outside view and then find the truth in it.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Suzanne Young, the author of The Program. So, I can see why this book is getting a lot of buzz and a lot of attention, because not only is it dealing with a subject that's very topical, but it's also kind of fits into the, the genre that seems to be the genre of the moment, which is a futuristic world with a female heroine.
Yeah, I think
fighting
and it's
system.
Funny because I certainly didn't set out to write anything dystopian or anything like that. And I actually just pitched it as science fiction when I had written it. But as an author, you don't get to decide, you know, where the book is placed. But I think it works because it's it fits into the genre, and yet it has like something different because it is not quite like the end of the world like the other popular books.
Right, right. And there isn't the level of violence, I guess. It's more internal. It's more introspective.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, there have been recently suicides because of bullying.
Oh.
And that is the saddest thing I can think of. And I know, I mean, I'm not on the internet or anything, so I don't. But I can imagine that when these things are, you know, things are posted and so forth, that it can be very, very damaging to a young person whose brain isn't fully developed yet, and they're just, you know, it's really awful.
Mm. And they have these grown up things happening to them, and they don't have necessarily the faculties to deal with it. And
yeah.
I see it a lot with my students too, just. Stuff online. When I was in high school, we didn't have the internet, so I never had to worry about what people said about me online. You didn't have like this, this online cyberbullying. I mean, it didn't exist, and it was still pretty bad back then. So now I think it's just magnified so much more.
I mean, there's always been gossiping and so forth, but you know, talking behind people's back and everything, but nothing to the extent that it is now, because it goes all over the school. And,
yeah.
You know.
Well, Suzanne, how much of a problem is teen suicide now?
I would say more than, I mean, with teen suicide, you have, you know, obviously these different levels. I mean, it's definitely, it's now that you have the internet and you have people who go online and will post, are able to post goodbye messages, things like that. Like, I think that's when you talk about it, online and you see this, it seems like, oh, look, maybe this person is getting back at people, when you know what, that's not what happens. That's not how it works. What happens is you hurt all the people around you that cared about you. I think it's something that needs to be talked about, but I think we don't talk about it by glorifying it or romanticizing it. We need to talk about it in the way that we're showing how it affects the people around you and the fact that there is a way through it. I mean, there is a way through it, and if you could just get some perspective on the length of life, you would see that this is just a small blip, really. I mean, high school, what is high school? It's, you know, you're going to be past it. But I found that people are afraid to talk about it. You know, I teach at a school, and when the book came out, a lot of my students came to the book signing. They were very proud of me. But at the school, they were concerned with me talking. Obviously, I'm not into book censorship because I'm an author. And I was like, okay, you know, I understand. But I found I had a neighbor that came over the other day, and she's 15, and she told me that she had been cutting 2 years ago, that she was cutting. And when she read the program, her parents saw her with it and were a little concerned because it's about suicide. And she told me, she said, but I explained to them that this is not a book about suicide. This is a book about hope. And she's like, and I felt so good. She's like, because it made me realize that those feelings I had were not just me being crazy. They were feelings that other people had. And she's like, and then by the end, it made me want to find somebody or something to live for and this and that. And I just thought it was the greatest thing to hear it from a teenager's mouth. Like,
oh, wow.
To relate to it. And
wow.
I really enjoyed that.
Well, you know, I was talking with somebody yesterday, and she was saying that she had a, you know, situation, and then she found out that she wasn't the only one that had that situation. She went to a, you know, group. And this is what happens. We think when something's happening to us, we think we're the only ones that it's happening to. And then we find out.
And loneliness is just the worst feeling. And that's the thing, too, with social media is, you know, in my classroom, my students have to turn off their phones. And by the end of the class, like, they can't turn them on fast enough.
I believe it.
About it. And I was like, it's like you are so, the kids nowadays are so connected in every, like, every minute of every day, they're connected. And so when they're not connected, they feel so lonely. And it's amazing how, you know, destructive loneliness can be if you never had to experience it. And that's kind of what we have now, is people are never experiencing loneliness. And so I think it is important to have books about issues, because if you can't, you know, not everyone wants to talk about their dark thoughts, especially, you know, unless it's anonymously. So I think reading books about topics that you don't want to share with everybody is a good way to kind of learn that other people have the same thoughts that you do sometimes.
Well, this came up recently here in Fairfield, where where we had a really tragic suicide not that long ago, and people talked about how there's such a tendency to keep those feelings to yourself and not share them, not just because you think it's just you, but because you think other people will think there's something wrong with you if you admit to feeling depressed, feeling suicidal. And some people, you know, posted on this Facebook page saying, look, this, I've been dealing with this my whole life. Hardly anybody knows it.
Yeah.
Hardly anyone knows that.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry to hear about that tragedy. I mean, that is just, it's devastating because we don't talk about it. You know, nobody knows, nobody can help. But also there's some, you know, you do get some judgment, or, you know, especially if anyone's sad. Like, you're not expected to be sad. People expect you to be happy.
Yeah.
We have pills for that. We have things that we're supposed to put out a certain persona. And that's not the truth. I mean, I don't know anyone who is happy all the time, but we're not supposed to show how sad we can be. And I remember when I struggled in high school with depression, and it wasn't even so much that there was anything to blame other than I was just really, really sad. And I remember my vice principal at the time told me, he's like, you're always smiling. And I always think about that now. The reason nobody kind of took it seriously was because I always smiled. I always put on this certain front because that was what I was supposed to do. And so that's why I think it's important to be able to talk about it, because there's things you're supposed to do, but then there's the reality of the situation.
Okay, tell me this. These teenagers, what do they talk about all the time with one another? Do they, if they have to be connected all the time, what do they talk about?
Yeah, they talk about music and movies, and it's not too terribly deep. You know, I mean, it's the kind of social media, you know, where you have to do it in 120 characters or less. So it's like a lunch today, this is where we're going this weekend, that was the best. And then every so often someone will put up something very sad. But when they put up those sad posts, it's almost always for immediate reaction. Like, you put up these reactionary posts. Like, you want someone to say, no, you're so pretty, or no, you're doing great. And so you see that a lot.
Okay.
People online is if they put up something negative, it's almost always for an immediate response. And it's you know, a cry for help, but at the same time, it's also, you know, you should maybe talk to someone other than other teens when you do have, you know, thoughts like that.
Now, I saw some statistics that actually were sent out with your kind of cover information about teen suicide, and it really was shocking to me. The number of, this was, I think, in 2009. Do you have those statistics?
Well, I have it. In 2005, Gallup reported estimated 5% of adolescents suffered from major depression. And in 2004, 1 in 10 teens reported thinking about their own death. Often 30% of teens reported thinking about their own death sometimes.
Wow.
So.
And I think it was even,
was it the
there
top,
was
maybe?
One, in 2009, among high school students in the United States, 17.4% had considered suicide of females, and 10.5% of boys.
I found it really interesting when I was looking
wow.
at the statistics. The amount of people that consider suicide and think about suicide is absolutely staggering. I mean, it's, you look at that and it's shocking. And then there's also the fact that, you know, with access to certain things, the teen suicide rate goes up. So with for guys, for boys, the rate is of succeeding in a suicide is much higher, and that's because they usually use a weapon. But it just the sheer amount of teens thinking about suicide is, it's disturbing, and it obviously is, you know, means that we should be doing something about it. I mean, there has to be something we can do to at least talk to them about it.
Okay.
Do you think that this program idea is
was the cure worse than the disease?
That's what I'm wondering.
You know, I wanted it to be really, I purposely wanted it to be kind of a question through the book. I think as a parent, I have two children. I understand, you know, someone had once told me, like, oh, the parents are so unlikable, and I'm like, they're trying to save their child. What wouldn't you do to save your child?
Yeah.
So I think from the parents' perspective, I can see why they would go to the program. I can see why you would have it. And then from the teen's perspective, I can understand why you wouldn't want your entire life erased, and what kind of adult would you be if you didn't have anything happen to you as a teenager to shape your personality. And so I kind of just always, I never really say in the book which which way I think it is. I mean, I think it's not the right answer, but it works. So there is that.
It works, except I also, and maybe this wasn't intentional, but I felt like you were also saying, well, some of these teenagers were getting depressed and suicidal because of their fear of the program.
And that's what book two is about.
Ah.
There's a sequel. There's just two books that comes out next year called The Treatment. And that's about them trying to figure out what effect the program is having on the epidemic. And is the program actually contributing to the epidemic?
But in this world, not all districts or countries are using the program. So they have the opportunity to compare statistics from one group to another.
Right. So this was just kind of, the book starts with this pilot run of the program. This is their first time kind of trying it out. And then in the second book, it's become a treatment. They've opened up other centers because to them, on paper, it looks very successful. Because it's very kind of a hush-hush operation. It's not advertised. They kind of control a lot of the media that comes out of it. And so it looks successful, and so other countries are adopting it in other states. And so that's why the characters have such concern of finding out, like, is the epidemic partly caused because of the program, and what is this going to mean?
Right.
Because it's kind of ironic, you know, that the program should cause more thoughts of suicide among the kids. For instance, if they come back and they don't know anybody anymore, and they feel like Sloan feels like she should know this, you know, it would have been horrible. I think it would have been awful to be in that position.
Yeah. Or when you see your friends coming back that way and know that their lives have changed, and you just don't want that to happen, and you do anything to make it not happen. But so your character Sloan is on, she's on edge all the time.
Yeah, and if she cries, if anybody sees her crying about anything, then they think, oh, she's got to go to the program. But people cry. I mean, you know, you cry.
That's kind of like the epidemic was, they were so worried about people getting sick that they were no longer allowed to show emotions, and it kind of ties in with what we were talking about earlier about how you're not supposed to show that you're sad in today's society. You know, you're supposed to. And so it's kind of like an exaggerated version of that, where they have to look like they got it together at all times. And instead, they come back from the program even after they've been, you know, cured, if you call it that. They still have loneliness, and they still have to suffer loneliness. But now they don't have anything to compare it to. Now it's a new emotion, and it's overwhelming.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Suzanne Young, the author of The Program. So, Suzanne, tell us a little bit about your earlier books that were published. Are they were also young adult, teenage novels, and are they as serious, or are they lighter in tone?
My first series was very light in tone. I've always written very serious novels, and for that series I had gone kind of tongue-in-cheek. But my last series before this one was called The Need So Beautiful, and it's a very serious book about, it's paranormal, sorry, supernatural, and it's about a girl who is compelled to help people. Like, she's physically compelled to be somewhere and tell someone something that kind of changes the course of their life. But for her, she doesn't want this gift, she doesn't want to do this, and especially not when she finds out that she is what's called a forgotten, which is a kind of being that's kind of like a guardian angel in a way, but someone that just comes into your life, says something, like maybe someone you're standing next to in line, they say something, and then you never see them again. And you can never quite remember them, like a deja vu. And what's happening is every time she helps someone, she's slowly being erased from existence, and she knows that that's what she's meant to do. She's meant to sacrifice herself for the good of other people.
That sounds interesting.
She doesn't want to, because she's an average teenage girl, you know.
That sounds interesting.
It's a dark kind of look at sacrifice, but at the same time, you know, what would you do for the good of other people? And so that's what that series is about.
Wow. Interesting.
And you said that was a series?
Yes. Yeah, so the first one was called The Need So Beautiful, and the second one was called The Want So Wicked. because you have two different kinds of beings. You have the forgotten who spread good, and then you have the shadows, which spread misery. So the second book is kind of about their existence.
And are there more books in that series coming?
I have an e-novella coming out from Harper that just kind of finishes up the story. It's just mainly just the two books, and then I just have the novella that kind of ties it up for fans of the series.
And then what was your first series?
It's kind of funny to say. Okay. So it's called, it's going to seem so crazy compared to the other books. All right. But it's called The Naughty List. And it was not my title when I published it, but it's about it's about a group of cheerleaders, and they the one girl had been scorned at some point, and so they create a club that investigates cheating boyfriends. So if a girl at the school thinks that her boyfriend is cheating on her, she contacts this super secret society, and they go and investigate it. It's very kind of upbeat and funny, but when you get deeper into the book, you realize there's a lot deeper issues, but that's not what the cover shows, it's kind of one of those books that is a little bit different than the way it's presented, because it does get a little bit more into the feelings of betrayal and what that feels like, and how this main character, Tessa, is trying to be perfect, because then she'll keep her family together. Like, she brings on this guilt of her parents' divorce, and if she could just be perfect, then her family can be perfect. And so there's a deeper meaning to it, but the pitch is a group of cheerleaders who spy on cheating boyfriends.
Your audience for that obviously would be the teen market.
Yes, that one was very teen. Yes. And both The Needs So Beautiful and The Program are my crossover books. And I would find that a lot of the people that really connect to the book are older. They're either in their late teens or older. I don't necessarily think about teens when I'm writing the book. I think about the teens I'm writing about, but I don't think about the audience. I just try to tell the truth of the character, whether it's something I believe in or not. Once you have this character, you write what they would do. And so for me, I think these books have been successful because of the crossover appeal. But then I have Just Like Fate that comes out next month, and that one kind of goes back to the teen. Like, that one is definitely more teen-oriented.
And would you like to write truly adult novels, too? Is that kind of where you're heading, like J.K. Rowling?
I would love to write. I'd love to just write what I want to write without having to think about, is this the kind of book that will get pulled from the library? I don't want...
oh, yeah, right, sure.
I just want to tell an honest story. So I think there's just a little bit more... I have to think about more of the impact when I write young adult. So I would like to write adult eventually, so that I could just kind of tell the story and be as, as morally ambiguous as I want without having to teach a lesson. maybe eventually. Luckily my publisher, Simon Schuster, they're big fans, and so they kind of love that my books skew older, and they love that crossover appeal. So it's kind of like I found the perfect spot right now.
Oh, that's good. It's interesting, though, that you say that you have to sort of teach a lesson in a teen book. Because obviously teens don't want to read for a lesson, but in order to get published, you have to be more, what is it that you're really saying there?
I have to be really aware of everything that I put into the book. So if I put something in a book that is, a little bit more mature content-wise, I have to have a really good reason to have it in there. If I don't, then... even if my publisher allows it, that's something that I could then get a lot of criticism for, get a lot of backlash for. Like, again, my own school was worried about my book just because it dealt with suicide. Not even because they read it, but just because it dealt with the subject of suicide. So when you write a young adult novel and you want it to be published and you want it to be successful, it's not that you have to go and say, this is what you do, kids. It's about telling a story that isn't trying to be shocking for the sake of shocking. It's got to have some kind of a moral compass to it, I think. And sure, people will say, oh, just write what you want, but those ones, they're taking a tougher path. So I think it's just in a young adult book, there's scenes that I write that I would cut out before I send it in because it's just not the right audience for it. And so you always have to be conscious of your audience in young adult, whereas an adult, you can kind of say what you want as long as you're writing it well, it's okay. But in young adult, you cannot do that.
And one thing to keep in mind that young adult doesn't necessarily mean 16, 17. It often means 11, 12 years old.
Yeah, so my books are all, they're 14 and up, but even for 14-year-olds, you know, that I don't give my students my books. I'm not one of those teachers that's like, everyone buy my book. yeah, my creative writing students love to come to the book signing and they bought the book. But you know, for me, it's kind of, it's up to the teen if they think they're ready for a book like that, and some of them aren't, and they don't read it. If it's not something they're interested in, they don't read it. So I'm never worried about corrupting anyone with my books, because I've tried to get kids to read books like The Great Gatsby, which is fantastic, and they're not interested in it. So it doesn't matter how much you push, they'll read the spark notes on it if they don't want to read it.
Well, Suzanne, speaking of reading, would you like to read from the program for us today?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that sounds great. I'll just probably start at the beginning so it won't be too confusing.
Okay. So we can do about 7-8 minutes.
Okay.
Great.
Sounds good. All right. So the book is actually split into three parts. And part one is called Uncomfortably Numb, and it's everything that happens before the program. Okay. Chapter one. The air in the room tastes sterile. The lingering scent of bleach is mixing with the fresh white paint on the walls, and I wish my teacher would open the window to let in a breeze. We're on the third floor, so the paint is sealed shut, just in case anyone gets the urge to jump. I'm still staring at the paper on my desk when Kendra Phillips turns around in her seat, looking me over with her purple contacts. You're not done yet? I glance past her to make sure Mrs. Portman is distracted at the front of the room, and then I smile. It's far too early in the morning to properly psychoanalyze myself, I whisper. I'd almost rather learn about science. Coffee spiked with quick death would help you focus on the pain. My expression falters. Just the mention of the poison is enough to send my heart racing. I hold Kendra's empty stare, a deadness behind it that even purple contacts can't disguise. Her eyes are ringed with heavy circles from lack of sleep, and her face is thin sharply. She's exactly the kind of person who can get me in trouble, and yet I can't look away. I've known Kendra for years, but we're not really friends, especially now. Not when she's been acting depressed for close to a month. I try to avoid her, but today there's something desperate about her that I can't ignore. Something about the way her body seems to tremble even though she's sitting still. Cotton looks so serious, she says, lifting one bony shoulder. I'm just kidding, Sloane. And hey, she adds, as if just remembering the real reason she turned to me in the first place. Guess who I saw last night at the wellness center? E. Klamath. She leans forward as she tells me, but I'm struck silent. I had no idea that Lacey was back. Just then the door opens with a loud click. I glance toward the front of the classroom and freeze, my breath catching in my throat. The day has just become significantly worse. Two handlers with crisp white jackets and comb-smooth hair stand in the doorway, their expressionless faces traveling over us as they seek someone out. When they start forward, I begin to wilt. Kendra spins around in her seat, her back rigid and straight. Not me, she murmurs, her hands clasped tightly in front of her like she's praying. Please, not me. From her podium, Mrs. Portman begins her lesson as if there's no interruption, as if people in white coats should be walking in during her speech on the kinetic theory of matter. It's the second time the handlers have interrupted class this week. The men separate to opposite sides of the classroom, their shoes tapping on the linoleum floor as they come closer. I look away, opting to watch the leaves fall from the trees outside the window instead. It's October, but the summer has bled into fall, bathing us all in unexpected Oregon sunshine. I wish I could be anywhere else right now. The footsteps stop, but I don't acknowledge them. I can smell the handlers near me, antiseptic, like rubbing alcohol and Band-Aids. I don't dare move. Kendra Phillips, a voice says gently, can you please come with us? I hold back the sound that's trying to escape from behind my lips, a combination of relief and sympathy. I refuse to look at Kendra, terrified that the handlers will notice me. Please don't notice me. No, Kendra says to them, her voice choked off. I'm not sick. Miss Phillips, the voice says again, and this time I have to look. The dark-haired handler leans to take Kendra by the elbow, guiding her from the chair. Kendra immediately lashes out, yanking one arm from his grasp as she tries to clamber over her desk. Both men descend on her as Kendra thrashes and screams. She's barely 5 feet, but she's fighting hard, harder than the others. I feel the tension rolling off the rest of the class, all of us hoping for a quick resolution, hoping that we'll make it another day without getting flagged. I'm not sick, Kendra yells, breaking from their hold once again. Mrs. Portman finally stops her lesson as she looks on with a pained expression. The calm she's trying to exude is fraying at the edges. Next to me, a girl starts crying, and I want to tell her to shut up, but I don't want to attract attention. She'll have to fend for herself. The dark-haired handler wraps his arms around Kendra's waist, lifting her off the floor as she kicks her legs out. A string of obscenities tear from her mouth as saliva leaks from the corners. Her face is red and wild, and all at once, I think she's sicker than we ever imagined. That, the real Kendra, is no longer in there, and maybe hasn't been since her sister died. My eyes well up at the thought, but I push it down. Down deeper, I can keep all of my feelings, until later when there's no one watching me. The handler puts his arm over Kendra's mouth, muffling her sound as he whispers soothing things in her ear, continuing to work her bucking body toward the door. The other handler dashes ahead to open it. Just then, the man holding Kendra screams and drops her, shaking his hand as if she bit him. Kendra jumps up to run, and the handler lunges for her, his closed fist connecting with her face. The shot sends her into Mrs. Portman's podium before knocking her to the ground. The teacher gasps as Kendra flops in front of her, but Mrs. Portman only backs away. Kendra's top lip is split open, leaking blood all over her gray sweater and the white floor. She barely has time to process what happened when the handler grabs her by the ankle and begins to drag her, caveman style, toward the exit. Kendra screams and begs. She tries to hold on to anything within her reach, but instead she's leaving a trail of blood along the floor. When they finally get to the doorway, she raises her purple eyes in my direction, reaching out her reddened hand to me. "Sloan," she screams, and I stop breathing. The handler pauses, glancing over his shoulder at me. I've never seen him there before today, but something about the way he's watching me now makes my skin crawl, and I look down. I don't lift my head again until I hear the door shut. Kendra's shouts are promptly cut off in the hallway, and I wonder momentarily if she was tasered or injected with a sedative. Either way, I'm just glad it's over.
Oh, boy.
That was Chapter 1 of the program by Suzanne Young.
It grabs your attention.
Yeah.
It's a pretty it's a pretty intense scene, and it's actually not the first scene that I wrote. I had written it a certain way, and then I went back and decided to add it. Instead of having like a buildup of this is what's going on in the world, I figured I would show it.
Yes.
And the character goes into talking about what's happening in the world. But I thought that way would be a great way to kind of show how scary it could be. For the teens involved, how scary it could be.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
gosh, yes.
You know, do you, you know, what do you want, or do you have any goals for how this book can open the conversation about this subject?
I've talked to, I've talked to a lot of teens, obviously, when, you know, in school, but also when I was out on tour and people that have read the book. And I think it helps the fact that it is at the point where it's an epidemic and you have, you know, this agency that's kind of coming in to cure them. I think it makes them feel like they can talk about it more because it's not quite so realistic in the world sense, but it's realistic in the emotional sense.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I found that they can identify with it. And what I want is that when you get through the entire book, although it's very scary in the beginning and it's kind of, you know, it kind of spirals into getting darker and darker and darker, but then you have these moments of just pure hope. Like, you have these flashbacks into her relationships, and you see that they weren't all bad, and it's not all black and white. Like, there's some things to hope for, and once you find that thing to hope for, it could be enough to get you through it. And so that's what I want people to take away from it, is that it's not a depressing book about suicide. I mean, it definitely has some dark moments, but ultimately it's about fighting for your life and coming out on the other side.
And have you gotten other feedback from, you know, you talked about your neighbor, and but have you gotten other direct feedback from teens for whom this has made a difference reading this book?
Yes, I get a lot of emails. I'm obviously in person. People will say they like it and it really touched them, but they don't like to go into details. But I get a lot of emails from teens, and I think one of the first bits of feedback I got was when I was promoting my last book, A Want So Wicked. I was doing a book signing for that, and I had talked about the program, and I read the first chapter of the program. And at the end of the signing, I had a lady come to me, and she told me, she's like, "I just pre-ordered the book." She's like, "I just want to tell you that my husband had committed suicide 6 months ago after coming back from Afghanistan." And she said, "The way you described Kendra, the way you described the girl in the classroom," she's like, "that described my husband perfectly in the last few weeks of his life." She's like, and I like that because now people would know what to look for in a person like that. But she found it to be very, and she emailed me after she read the book, and she was very she's very, you know, honest and just saddened, but she said that it was just one of the most honest portrayals of depression and people who would consider suicide. Like, and I thought that was just such a great compliment that you can capture a moment that maybe not everyone can relate to, but at least it's a realistic moment that they would then know about by reading about it, even if they didn't experience it themselves. Mm.
Yeah. Did, when you were writing about this, like your little bio says that you, it says that you search your own tragic memories for inspiration. So did this, writing about this, bring back memories from your youth that were difficult for you to deal with, or did it help you process them?
I think perspective has given me a much better understanding of what I went through. For me, it was a combination of loneliness and abandonment, that when I did start to become so sad that it was unable to function, I had found that a lot of people left, like a lot of people couldn't handle that. And so I think for some of, you know, I'm kind of one of those people that when I'm writing, I get like completely fully invested in it. And, I cried through several scenes in the book, and one of the scenes that broke my heart the most was when the handlers come for Sloane, and also later on when she must say goodbye to the certain memory from her own past that she knows is being erased. Mm-hmm. So it's never a specific. I never write like anything specific that happened to me. But what I take from my past is those emotions. Like I can connect with those emotions, and it's kind of like universal truths that. You know, this feeling of loneliness can apply to many different situations, and I can always kind of go back to that and what it felt like and describe it. So I kind of never use anything specific, but use those emotions to channel into something to make it realistic.
Now, Suzanne, you mentioned you teach school, you have two children, and you've published 4 or 5 books in the last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. When do you sleep?
Yeah. So what's your writing schedule like that you're able to do all that?
Oh, well, it's a little bit hectic. I have 3 more books coming out, maybe 4. We'll see soon. I should get news on that. What happened is I had 2 years where my kids were little and I was staying home. And I did a lot of the writing then. But when I first started writing my first book, I was working at an office. I had actually taken a break from teaching because we had moved. And I was working in an office. And I would sit there. I would enter in the data I had to enter. And then I would just have another document open and would be adding to the manuscript. And then I started teaching. And on my lunch break, I would go sit in my classroom and just write. I had written in a notebook, actually. My first book was written in a notebook because I didn't have a laptop. And so it became like that, and then I had time to write a few novels when I wasn't working, and now I just have to find time. It's pretty difficult. When I'm teaching, during the summer is when I do a lot of the writing, but it's also when I have to do a lot of revisions for other books, so it's kind of split. But during the day I teach. If I have a deadline, I'll write during my lunch period, and then I'll stay after school for a couple hours and write. And then the weekends. I haven't had a weekend off in a really long time.
Well, I know maybe I had graded too many papers because that's about all I did when I was an English teacher. I had
you gave too much homework, Mom.
You think? Maybe so.
It was always kind of a joke. I'm like, I do so much writing. You guys are stealing all of my creativity because I have to use all this creativity to keep these lessons interesting. During the weekend is pretty much where most of my drafting comes in if I'm writing something new because it's not usually on the same kind of deadline. So, my weekends, sometimes I go and stay in a hotel, and my husband, you know, takes care of the kids, and I go stay in a hotel, you know, down the street and lock myself away with a bunch of Diet Pepsi and some candy and draft a book.
Wow. Well, you must write pretty quickly.
Yeah, I usually write quickly. I write slower now than I used to. I used to write a lot faster, but now that I've published books and understand, you know, the writing process even more, like every book you write, you learn more. I edit more as I go now than I used to. I used to be able to just draft a book and just spit all the ideas out and then rework it later, but now I kind of, I make it the best I can as I go. So it's slowed me down a little bit. But at this point, I think I'm about 2 books a year I can write.
And do you have anyone else that that's like editing as you go kind of thing? Do you have someone who's reading as you're producing chapters now and help you with editing?
I do. I have a couple of other, there's a couple of other writers who were actually aspiring writers back when we all started. And we've just kind of stuck together through out this path. One of them is Trish Doler, who has a book, Something Like Normal, which is fantastic, and she's a contemporary author. And another is Bethany Griffin, who did a retelling of Mask of the Red Death. And so we've kind of just always stuck together and kind of passed chapters back and forth. And then occasionally I have other people, like bloggers, people who blog book reviews, that I'll occasionally ask their opinion on a section, and they'll give me some feedback. But for the most part, I have other authors who read for me. And then at last year, I let some of my students read a couple chapters to just get their opinion, some of my creative writing students, because they thought that was really fun. They wanted to see what a raw manuscript looked like before an editor got their hands on it.
Wow. That's
they weren't too scared by that.
That must have been very exciting for them. And do you have students who really want to be writers and want, you know, have you had people say, oh, will you show this to your agent for me? Will you show this to your editor for me?
You know, I haven't had anyone ask me that. I've only had, I think maybe it's the age, but for the most part, it's more a question of them being able to finish a project.
Yeah.
A lot of them have great ideas, but have just not, they have a lot going on and just haven't gotten to that point of discipline where they can pass up life and write instead, because really that's what it takes to be a writer. But they do love reading, and they didn't. At my school in particular, they didn't have young adult books. They had all the classics in the library, which I love classics. They're wonderful. But I think having books for fun is just as important, because I think you need to unlock the love of reading to get people to read all sorts of things. If everything is always a chore and a task, you're going to have a generation of people who hate reading.
That's right.
But if you let them read some of the things that they enjoy and they learn to love reading in its entirety, then they'll be able to read the other books.
What are some of the books that your students are really loving right now?
Ooh, let's see. So they do love the program. I will say. they love romance, like Sarah Dessen. Her books are really popular. They're also super into horror type books. So I have Anna Dressed in Blood, which is by Kandera Blake, which is a great book, and 10 by Gretchen McNeil. And so those ones are always kind of off the shelf. They kind of just love. If you look at movies, that's kind of a reflection of what kids like. It's kind of that same kind of idea. But they just love, they like stories, they like stories that are sad, but end up being really happy. That's what a lot of them look for, I think, is to have this mimic of their own, you know, perceived sadness, but then to have this hope at the end of it, and they do like Happily Ever After. They do like it to be a happy ending.
Now, Suzanne, one thing I'm wondering about, as you were facing all the rejection in the early years, did you ever consider self-publishing?
Self-publishing wasn't really a thing when I started.
If you were in that same situation now, would you?
Now, I think now that I have a base, I would consider it. But I don't know if people realize when they're self-publishing how hard it is to be noticed.
Yeah.
It's great to have a free book if you just want people to read your books, and even 99 cents. But what you really need the support of a publisher, and not even published authors get that, but
right.
You need that to get placement. You're not going to be placed into bookstores. You're not going to get placed into Walmart or Costco or Target if you're self-publishing your book, unless it gets picked up. There's also the fact that an editor does know the market, and they do have a pretty good grasp on language. And here it is, I'm an English teacher, and they edit my books. I mean, there's things you don't see in your own writing, but I think you do need that outside eye. So if you're going to self-publish, I think you would just need someone that's a really great, great editor or freelance editor to help you through it. And then you'll need to figure out a platform. Like, you'll need some kind of a a platform to be able to get your book out there. Otherwise, it's just going to get lost in the, you know, tens of thousands of other self-published books and published books, because you're competing with them too.
Absolutely. Well, Suzanne, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Do you have any last words of advice for aspiring writers?
Absolutely. It's don't give up, and it's to keep writing, because in my opinion, every book you write, you learn something new, and your craft, you know, you have to really just kind of hone your craft and just keep writing books.
Thank you. And we have some last words from Caroline.
Yes. There is a light at the end of every tunnel, but some tunnels are longer than others.
And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Earth Wild, and if you're listening on Monday morning, have a great week. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.